All right, good evening. This is the Water Resources and Watershed Committee meeting, starting at 5:30, February 8th. Before we begin, I have to go ahead and read off these announcements. So this meeting is being conducted in person at the Engineering Services Section Boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the agency's Zoom meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the committee using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. In the event there's a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in option or internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. Remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click the raise hand feature in Zoom. You will be notified when it's your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial *9 to raise your hand. Phone participants will be called on by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it's your turn to speak, dial *6 to unmute. For the public attending in person, there are public comment cards on the table outside. Please complete and return them to the administrator to help expedite public comments. The procedure for the next meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I'll ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from committee members. Then the committee comes to consensus to move an item to the board for consideration. Any PowerPoints shown at tonight's meeting will be posted to the SCV Water website. This time, all committee members are present, and we will go ahead and continue with item number one, Pledge of Allegiance, and Director Cooper, would you like to let us do this, which I'd be honored.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Cooper, seated. We move on to the public comment, and we do have a public comment from Ms. Feldmeyer. Ms. Feldmeyer, please go ahead.
Yes, do I have to stand up or... I've been covering a lot of your meetings, as you know, for quite a long time. And I'm really getting very disturbed by what I'm seeing. And one of your last actions was to leave all this money in Devil's Den, which is in another county. It's nowhere close to us at all. And yet that's what you chose to do. And I guess that's what set me off and saying, really questioning why that was done and why you're keeping it. And yet you just done the public for everything you take. It's not giving a good flavor as to what you're doing. And I'd say right now, I wouldn't vote for any of you. And I hope it will come down where we can vote. And right now, it's just like the public is do whatever we want. Doesn't make any difference. We're all in the same boat. We know what we want to do. But what is it you want to do? And I saw that when I saw that. Oh, well, we'll keep this money here. First thing you did. The very first thing. And I thought, if there's anything that's wrong, it's that. And that's just probably that much of what, you know, makes up the wrong you're doing. But I don't know what, but I'm hoping we get to a point where we can have a right to say, actually vote on who we want. And I don't know how close we are to that, but I hope we are very close. Because the gentleman that died, that was his intent. I knew that. I had watched that because I was very upset by what was going on already. And then I saw what he set up. And then he died. So I was watching if it would be put through the way it was supposed to be. And I think you're not there. The public has to have a vote. And it's been getting where it's really ridiculous at the main meetings. Just plain ridiculous. And I don't know what you plan to do,
Ms. Oldmeyer,
or what you will do, but I do know what I plan to do. Thank you.
Thank you. So everyone on this committee, every director has been elected. Mr. Cole, can you just briefly state the benefits of Devil's Den?
I'll try briefly. I think there are many. The original acquisition of the property was designed to allow for the transfer of the Table A water that was associated with the Devil's Den Water District. That has been done. That water has been supplying this community for since then. It was 12,700 acre feet. For the committee and Ms. Stoltmeyer, we are undergoing a study right now to look at the future use of the property. We are evaluating the potential for groundwater usage on the property as well as solar. And there are some other unique things that are being evaluated. So we'll be able to present that to the committee. It's going to be a few months yet, but call it the next phase of that asset and what it could provide for the valley and the ratepayers.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cole. Yeah, and we have sought a collaboration of Provost and Pritchard and Thompson Harder and company to analyze the uniqueness of Devil's Den. Ms. Kang, any other public questions or comments?
There are none at this time.
Okay. In that case, we move on to section 3.3.1, presentation of Goldson model presented by Najwa Pitovas. Ms. Pitovas, is that correct pronunciation?
Pitova, yeah.
Pitova. Close.
Good evening, and happy to be here to present to give a status update of the Goldson model development. And I just need to share my screen 1 second. Just realized.
Does everybody know Najwa? Let me start there real quick. Yeah, Gary, have you met Najwa before?
Just right now, I guess.
Oh, well, Ali, why don't you do a quick introduction? I couldn't remember if we had introduced Najwa.
We have virtually, but I don't think in person yet.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
I think it's best for Nigel to introduce herself to the committee, since this is the first, I think, in person to do it. So
yeah, I think the conclusion was the word versus me, but that's fine. So I've been here a year. My background is in environmental and water resources engineering management. I worked about six plus years in LA on many local water resource development projects, as well as briefly on imported water. So I did a lot of work for LADWP, helping them do strategic planning and analysis for their portfolio and how, the regional recycled water program, which fits in, and how to phase it. I've worked on watershed projects such as the LA River Master Plan that encompassed, flood risk reduction as well as water supply opportunities along the river. There's just some distribution system modeling for the city of Pasadena. They wanted to do an emergency interconnection with LADWP. So I have a pretty broad background, but my focus in the past few years has been portfolio. So modeling, dynamic modeling for portfolio management and integration of, different components, so environmental, water resources, and economic analysis, and so on. So this was a great opportunity because this is what the agency is doing, looking holistically I think it's an exciting time to be in water resource planning, especially at places that are really embracing these different looking not just at water supply, but just how our actions impact, the environment, how the regulations, how the changing, climate and uncertainties and chemicals of emerging concern or contaminants, all of that is important. So that's, that's
welcome to the team. You definitely have a huge project ahead of you. You want to get out of the spreadsheet game. So,
all right,
go ahead.
That was one thing. Nafa's very highly educated. She has a PhD in civil environmental engineering, University of Illinois, Urbane. I hired her, I'm slapping it.
Would you like to recuse yourself?
I'm going to recuse myself about that, man. Yeah. I was very thrilled that she was willing to come on to the CDC team and the background that she brought.
If I add one thing, she is leading for our department the resiliency effort. That's, I think, will come back again to the committee. It has been presented to this committee a couple of years ago, and I think every year we have a presentation about the resiliency. And this is will come back again. And she's the staff who is leading that effort for us. In addition, which is the presentation today is part of that bigger picture, resiliency and reliability for the agency portfolio. Thank you.
Okay. Right. Ms. Pavel, the floor is yours.
Okay. So so the topic today is to provide a status update on the model development using GoldSim. So I will start by providing a background on reliability modeling and then describe the uses of the reliability model and the methodology for the model itself, so the logic that's used. And then I provide two examples of some preliminary results. The first is to compare the difference when you use a monthly time step versus an annual time step in modeling. And so this example, keep in mind, is not using the new logic that I've implemented in the GoldSim model. It's using the old logic that was used in the MBK model, but I wanted something, compare apples to apples. So kind of had to modify my GoldSim to suit that purpose. And then the second example begins to show the analytical capabilities of the new GoldSim model, how it's going to help the agency evaluate different either operational strategies, such as the groundwater basin or our imported supplies. Also, it would help analyze and compare different investment options, such as sites reservoir or new vacuum programs, and so on. And then finally, I'll describe the next steps, what the work, future work is. So So the as you know, the reliability model or reliability modeling has been used by the agency staff for more than 10 years to assess the adequacy of the agency's water resource portfolio to meet future demands. And the model that the agency had, we refer to it as the MBK model. And it's been very useful and helpful in the past to assess options for different investments and looking at different pathways to achieving reliability. But because of the agency wanting to really now start looking at how we can better coordinate, you know, the use of, for instance, conjunctive use of the groundwater basin with our imported supplies and how that might, you know, how does that change with our operational strategies of imported water. We needed to determine that a more robust model was needed to put in all these complex and nuanced operational strategies. And that's when the board authorized an update to the MBK, the old MBK model in the spring of 2021. So the goals were, you know, the reasons were to improve functionality, build expertise in-house, and have a platform that is easier to update and maintain. So the model, there is a model now that's been QA/QC'd, you know, it's the mass balance converges, it's correct. So it is an appropriate time to inform the committee of the progress that's been made. But it is not the final model, because, and I'll describe soon how, you know, based on the assumptions we make and we look at results, we go back and modify some of these assumptions. So that's where we're at now. So I think, as I mentioned before, the reliability model is used to assess the adequacy of the existing water resource portfolio. It gives us a way to quantitatively assess and compare the value of new investments. So we can, for instance, look at the value of participating in a new banking program such as AVAC, or maybe participating in sites reservoir. So this allows us quantitatively to compare these investments. It can also allow us to consider investments in conjunction with new operating strategies. And that's where I mentioned, again, earlier, if we were to maybe refine the way we're operating our groundwater basin or the way we use our imported, you know, the Table A water, this model will help us see what the benefits or drawbacks are. And then finally, we can look at the risks of interruptions to one or more supplies. So for instance, if in the future a new contaminant of emerging concern comes up and limits our ability to pump groundwater, we can use the model to see what that impact is on our reliability, on our portfolio. Or if we, you know, one of our banking programs is just not able to, we're not able to take that water from storage, we can assess that risk and find, you know, and look at a range of responses available for us. So this is a conceptual framework of the new model. I mean, and it's similar. The old model has some similarities. Really, the biggest difference is the time step and the operational rules. But what you can see on the left side, the input, you can see there's a lot of input going into the model. And that input comes from other models, such as demand forecasting or local groundwater pumping, which currently is coming from the GSP, or from the Department of Water Resources, CALSIM modeling, which gives us an idea of what our imported water allocations, Table A allocations might be. The center part, the model itself, is that's the analytical engine. We, based on, you know, working with Sarah, who does, right, the short-term water operations, so based on her experience and knowledge and then just our understanding of the state water, how it operates, we've come up with a set of assumptions on how the model decides to allocate these different water supplies to meet demand. So what I'm trying to say here is that we give it a set of I'm coding a set of assumptions. The model is agnostic to what the future is, and every time step, based on conditions, the model will decide how to use the water supplies. And then the output, there's a lot of output that can be generated. I've listed two that are usually the main ones presented: supply surplus and shortfalls. You know, these give us an idea of how much we need to invest in the future to meet reliability. And then the surplus gives us an idea of maybe what storage we need, you know, how much can we store. And of course, post-processing can be used to further quantify the benefits and costs of new investments. So in summary, we have input, which is mostly output from other models become input to this. We have an analytical engine, which defines the rules of operation, and then the output is the results I present to you. That we inform you so that you can guide us on policy decisions and direction. And as I mentioned earlier, these rules of operation are not set in stone. It's based on what we see in terms of output. We go back and refine them, try to find the best strategy for the agency. So it is really this iterative process, and that's why I say we're at a good point to present, to give an update that it's not the final model. So as we know, the California climate is highly variable. So we do consider variability through the use of multi-year sequences of wet and dry years. And then Department of Water Resources assumptions of climate change regulations and future development of the state water project are used. And these are in the form of CalSIM results that become input to the model. Similarly, variability of the local groundwater during wet and dry periods is used. And that was part of the GSP looking at climate change. So it's in there. And then we look at not just 1 year, but multi-year planning horizons that capture increase in demand and then different climate cycles. And so what I thought I would do is begin with, in a single time step, just a sample of what essentially is being done. So in this example, I have two scenarios. Scenario one and two, we have base supplies in blue. And then each scenario has water in storage. So I call it storage one and two, same amount of water in storage. Scenario one has more base supplies to begin with, and two has less. And so if we have a specified demand, you can see that in scenario one, our base supply is greater than demand. So you're going to put that excess water into storage, and then you would still end up with excess supply. In scenario two, your base supply is less than the demand, so you take water from storage, but we didn't have enough water in storage, so we would end up with a supply shortfall. So that's in a single time step. So it could be, depending on the model, 1 month or 1 year. When this is done over multiple hydrologic traces and the results are summarized, we get this statistical summary for a single year. So this is basically showing if I ran this over 94 different hydrologic sequences, you would get, this is the probability for, let's say, 2030, a level of development of what might happen. So it's capturing all the variability in climate. And what I want to show is this light, it looks purple on the screen, but this amount of water is, or let me back up. So the vertical axis shows our either supply surplus or deficit. So it's positive or negative. And what you see is that blue region is the supply surplus for this example. And then when you see negative values on the vertical axis, that's supply shortfalls. So in this example, what's happening is that we have all this surplus supply, but we have some storage, so we're able to put that purple shaded area into storage. And then we also have water in storage, so we're able to take water from our storage to meet that shortfall, and then we just reduce our amount of shortfall to the red area. So with these graphs, the reason where this is an established method that's used by DWR, Metropolitan Water District, and many other agencies in California. And what's helpful is when we start comparing scenarios, we're going to get these different graphs that show us what the reliability is. It'll give us an idea what the supply surplus and shortfalls are. So it's a way to compare between scenarios, but also it's a way to, it gives us an idea how much more water do we need, how much, you know, what do we invest in, or what potentially, for instance, could be recharge projects in our local groundwater basin in the surplus years. So I am going to now show a simple example of when I ran the model using a monthly versus annual time step. So I am using the old logic, which was in the MBK model. And what this is showing is that the logic was sequential. In every time step, we are always using our supplies to meet demand in the same order that's shown here up here. It's always the same. Similarly, when we have periods of surplus water, we are always filling or returning water to Castaic or our banks in that same order. It never changes. So that's where I said, you know, I modified the new Goldson model to use that same sequential logic so I could compare the difference between an annual and monthly time step. So the two graphs here show on the left is the annual time step graph, the reliability exceedance curve. And on the right is the monthly exceedance curve. And what I want to bring your attention to are the vertical lines, the green and blue. The blue is for the level, you know, for the demand year 2035. The green is for 2050. And you can see with the annual time step, we are predicting in 2035, 95% of the time we are reliable. But with the monthly time step, we are 85% of the time reliable. Keep in mind, this is a sample. I had to remove some of our base supplies so that I would minimize changing the logic in Goldson. So this is just an example. It's not what is the actual reliability today. It's a hypothetical example because
that makes us feel better.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. But it's really the essence here is just to show why going to a smaller time step is important. And so I chose 2 years to show what is happening again. So I have on the left a wet year and on the right a dry year. And so with each group of bar charts, the left is the annual time step, the right is the monthly time step. So what I did is for the monthly time step, I just summed up the values for each year. And so the colors show the different supplies being used to meet demand. So if we look at this wet year on the left, firm supplies used by both models is the same, which is as you would expect, because they are firm supplies. The blue is the amount of table A used. And you can see the annual model is using more table A than the monthly model. And that's because for that year, we started with 0% allocation in January and February. So the monthly model had to pull water from the banks versus the annual model just saw the final allocation, which is usually in May, and determined that we have enough imported supplies and use that water. So even though it was a wet year, we still, in the first 2 months, we still had some deficits. So that's where we have a supply shortfall here. And that's because also we're using a sequential logic. That wouldn't happen today.
This assumes that no carryover bar.
No carryover, yeah.
We'd make up that deficit earlier.
And so on the right is a dry year. Oh, sorry. And again, firm supplies are in yellow, and then table A, they're the same. And then the purple is water taken from semi-tropic to meet demand. It's the same. But then you can see in the annual model, the amount of water taken from Rosedale is also higher than in the monthly model. And the reason here is based on the monthly constraints of how we can use these supplies. And I'll show you in the next slide. And maybe this is too, yeah, it's a bit too small. But if you just look at the tables in red, it's showing you based on the terms of the contracts, the agreements we have with Rosedale and Semi-Tropic. Semi-tropic, we can't take water in the early month of the year. We can only start taking in May. And Rosedale, we can take more water in the winter month and less in later months. So that constrains. So, you know, in the annual model, it just assumes all that annual take capacity is available. The monthly model doesn't. So that's the reason. So the next example is now showing what the new Goldson model can help us do. And here I am showing what are in two scenarios so we can compare. So I have a base case scenario, which is our existing supplies today. They're all marked here. The DCR 2021 is basically the delivery capability report results from DWR for 2021 for future conditions. The only difference between the two scenarios is that in scenario one, I added a 2-to-1 exchange program with Rosedale Rio Bravo. So this is a potential program we could participate in. We don't currently. And I assume that, so the 2-to-1 means for every 2 acre feet we give Rosedale Rio Bravo, we can take back 1 acre foot. And then you know, with the new model, we are beginning to manage or simulate carryover water in St. Louis Reservoir. So we've made assumptions on what might be an ideal maximum carryover storage target in the reservoir. So any water above that maximum target is considered excess water, and that's what goes to the exchange program. So, and if you recall, the old model had sequential logic, and this new model is not sequential. And this is in very simple terms. What I'm trying to show here on the left is that in every time step, when we want to determine how to use our supplies, we look at all our supplies as a system, the available balances, and we make a decision. The model makes a decision on how to use our supplies. Do we use our table A first, or do we use our banking programs first? So in wet years, we will use our table A first. In dry years, the model starts pumping from the banks as soon as it determines that we're in a dry year. So that helps us, you know, when we have that extraction capacity, if you remember the constraints, the monthly constraints on take and put capacities, that kind of, you know, it's a workaround it. So we pump as soon as we can to try to meet our demand. And then if we have surplus water, then on the right, we are again looking at all our storage programs and deciding how to allocate that surplus water based on multiple objectives. One is meeting that target storage of carryover. And the second is we want to extend the life of each storage program. So we try to put water simultaneously in all of them instead of one at a time. So this graph here, again, these are all sample. They're not results for decision making. They are just examples. When I ran the base case with no Rosedale exchange and scenario one with Rosedale exchange, that's with the existing recovery capacity of 10,000 acre feet per year. You see, we don't have so the blue is the base case. The orange are the results with the Rosedale exchange program. And what I'm plotting here are just the final reliability results. Instead of the exceedance curves, I just see where we start running into supply shortfalls. And that's the number I've captured in these graphs. So when we do have the exchange program, you see there is no improvement in reliability. If anything, by 2050, we actually have a decrease. And what's happening here is that the Rosedale exchange program is extending the life of the regular Rosedale program, because now we have that water to draw from, but we are constrained. You know, we're just storing that water, but the results show we're not able to use that water when we need it. So what I did was I added at scenario two. So, you know, again, the blue is the base scenario with no Rosedale exchange. The orange is scenario one with Rosedale exchange and the existing recovery capacity of 10,000 acre feet per year. And scenario two is with Rosedale exchange, and I increased the recovery capacity to 20,000 acre feet per year. And that's, and you see now the gray bars have a substantive improvement in our reliability. So, so this example just demonstrates how we can use the model to assess not just the benefits from a program, but also how to potentially write the terms in our agreements, or, you know, what are the parameters that would benefit us. So, you know, we can do scenarios where we add now AVEC, and we look to see what's happening, or a mix of maybe, you know, AVEC and some exchange up to a certain amount of water and, you know, versus sites, reservoir, and so on. And so finally, my where I'm at now is I'm spending some time looking at some calcium outputs because we think the management of Article 56 could be improved. So that's where I'm working on updating the model logic for better representation of how we manage carried over water. And then once this is done, the plan is to perform multiple runs, and that's kind of what I mentioned earlier, maybe looking at AVEC. You know, there are decisions that will be made, that have to be made in the near future. The agency has to decide, do we continue participating with planning for a sites reservoir? Do we join a new banking program? Do we invest in our local groundwater basin, recharging it? So the goal here is to perform some runs and bring them back to you so that you can provide direction for future resilience work. So meaning you think maybe, you know, investing more in our local groundwater basin and reoperating the basin might be, you know, the direction you want to go, plus maybe with sites reservoir or AVEC or Irvine Ranch. So that's basically where we're headed with that model. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we ask you questions, any questions, comments from the public?
There is none.
Okay. Directors, questions, comments on presentation?
Thank you very much. This, you know, I can see where when this was sequential, it was much simpler, and decisions were easier to make, but not always the right decisions. This is a huge amount of data and a huge amount of decisions that can be made in that data to figure out which way to go. I'm very impressed with it. I think this is going to be a huge help. It's become, our water supply has become so much more complex than what it was in past years, that I think this is going to be excellent. So thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm glad you're doing it, because this would drive me nuts.
A good question.
Ms. Martin.
Well, thank you for the presentation. Good to meet you in person. Case I haven't before. In your last slide, you had update model logic. So the model logic is user-defined. The model itself allows the user to basically
yes.
input the logic.
Yes, and Yuni, can I reshare my...
Yes.
I haven't, you know, I didn't want to put too much here, but if you recall... Sorry, these are extras. Yeah, so the middle part, the analytical engine, because it's not sequential, we the idea here was that the agency can store carryover water, Article 56 in St. Louis. That's free storage for us. But it comes with the risk of spilling. So one of the major approaches in this logic is managing the storage of Article 56, where I mentioned, you know, earlier, we're playing with a maximum, these are user inputs, and what we think is a good maximum, you know, a range, a minimum and maximum Article 56, because we have seen really good improvements in reliability when we have access to this Article 56. There are kind of three approaches that the model will take based on these rules we've set. So in wet and kind of normal years, we're prioritizing the use of Article 56 and Table A first before the banks. But then in dry years, we're pumping water from our banks first, and we're using it to meet demand, but also back it up into San Luis so that we don't lose that take capacity. You know, if we have that take capacity in the winter, we want to take advantage of it instead of waiting till the summer when our demands are highest and we can take that water. So that's kind of where, you know, I mentioned we are playing with the or refining or revising the rules based on the output as we interpret results and see, is it behaving the way we thought it should? And, you know, in a manner that really maximizes the benefits for us.
So is this model used by our colleague agencies around the state, or?
You know, I'm just using a software. So, you know, Excel was used for the MBK model. I'm using a more robust software that's also easier to kind of visualize. With this, it's become a bit more complicated, but it has a nice, you know, I've developed a nice user interface so that, you know, my colleagues can use it and run analysis, or really anyone. But for instance, DWR uses a different platform, and theirs is way more complicated. They're doing physical, you know, modeling, hydrologic modeling plus operations. This is more operations focused. So some agencies use Goldsim, others prefer Excel or many other types of software. It's just the software, yeah.
Thank you. I'm glad you're doing it, not us. So.
Yeah, well, President Martin, I know that other water agencies are using it too. In fact, Ms. Pivoy, so the model that you're developing is more of like a graphic user interface so that it'll be easier for the agency staff to kind of manipulate the functions that you program into it and kind of do a quick check on them. Is that right?
They can manipulate the inputs.
Okay, but not the function, not the rules.
I mean, anyone who is familiar with the software can.
Right.
It's not a black box. Yeah. But my focus has been to make it user-friendly to be right now at this stage to be able to run, to have other people run it and interpret it.
How do you plan to do QC, QA on your functions that you wrote for each system?
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that?
Dirk, did you want to say?
No, I'll say.
Okay. So this is what's taken actually quite a while. You can do like one function, right, to do a QA QC on the entire model because it's not sequential and it's just so much is happening. So it's been split, you know, for each banking program, there's a QA QC function. And then the overall, you know, demand and supply and where it's coming, that's a QA QC. So it's been split into many, but then I've done some that I also have an ex-colleague from GeoSyntec who's been running a lot of scenarios. You know, I instruct her to, you know, run and analyze and look, and it's been an iterative process. But anytime I look at results, even before, even though I'm confident it works now, I'm always reviewing the results for mass balance before doing anything further.
Okay. So we're doing QC, QA in-house for each particular function, like one feedback loop, you look into it to make sure all the numbers, all the volumes, all the flow rates are correct.
And then globally, like the, okay. Yeah, where possible. Yeah.
Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chair, if I may add one thing, and I think this is something that Nigel shared also, is there's other staff members who actually have been using as QAQC. Sarah, who is running a lot, she understands a lot of the operations of the banking. She is providing back feedback to Nigel when she's doing that, and also Ernesto, I think. And she is presenting to them, she's using them in providing some of that QAQC internally.
Okay. And before I go to Director Marks, how many of our staff have access to GoldSend? How many have access and how many have been trained to use it?
We have one floating license. So if I check it back in, someone can check it out. Okay. But there is the player file. That's the user interface. When I generate that, anyone can open it. You don't need a license. I haven't, Sarah and Ernesto have seen the interface. We haven't set yet to train because I wanted to get the rules of operation to a point where we're not going to go back, in a month and say, no, stop using this. And let's use this version. So that's kind of where, but it's very user-friendly, very easy, very visual to see.
And before I go to Director Marks, I had this floating idea of maybe sharing that player file with the directors. Do you believe that's necessary this time, or is that going too much into detail,
I'll probably take that one. I think it's too much. I think if there's specific interests by specific directors, I think maybe we set up a different way to, satisfy that desire, rather than just putting it out to all. I think, it takes training and understanding to make sure you're interpreting results correctly. And that's what I would be concerned with. If others are not understanding the tool well enough, they could end up interpreting things not correctly. So I would encourage, if there's a desire for board members to have a deeper level of understanding, that we can set up some other, type of situation that we can work through that.
Still battling with micro versus macro management. Forgive me. Director Marks.
Thanks for the presentation, very encouraging. See the progress that's been made. On Article 56, I had a couple questions. Is the target storage in Article 56, is that one of the parameters that staff will be able to adjust, or is that more deeply embedded into the body?
Staff can adjust that.
Yeah. Article 56 is really extremely complex because it's not just what we do with our area, it's what all the other contractors do. So there's going to be a certain degree of uncertainty associated with that portion of our portfolio. It's just, I think, the nature of it. But it's so important, it's been so valuable to us, we can't just ignore it and say, oh, there's a lot of uncertainty there, so we're just going to ignore it, because we'd be likely really over-investing in other things that if we didn't read Article 56. But you always have to understand that there's the Is there a greater degree of uncertainty about that particular aspect of the portfolio than maybe other aspects?
I think that's a great point. I think, and we'll see that with Sarah when her presentation comes up tonight. That's exactly what we're managing is in real time, that risk management question. So I think it'll be a great tie when Sarah kind of walks through her presentation tonight, because that is what we're dealing with right now.
Well, Dr. Marks, do you believe that there are finite scenarios for Article 56 or infinite? Because if they're finite, I think we can program each one to Goldson. Is that right? When I mean finite, less than 100.
There are operational decisions that Metropolitan and Kern County will make that drive a lot of what we see at San Luis Reservoir. And Mets, it's on the last 2 years, Mets operation can be driven by a number of things, including about river hydrology. And their own distribution to stream. None of which I think that we should be in the business of trying to model those. I'm just turning out the knowledge.
And that's the, you know, when I said update the logic, that's pretty much what I'm focusing on now, is just this better representation of how we're managing Article 56. Because, you know, initial results, you know, based on certain assumptions, didn't make too much sense. And we are, you know, it's what Dirk said. There's Metropolitan, Kern, and then there's even TWR's assumptions when they give us the output that sometimes, you know, I think some of it might lead to conversations with TWR itself to understand what they're finding us and what they're doing.
Yeah, and that's a good point. If you look at the TWR sim model, as you go out into the future with climate change, Just the impact of climate change will tend to cause TWR to fill up San Luis more often than what we see today, because there's less snowpack that's coming down when we can put it to the use of it. You know, hitting us more at once. And
storage is chain storage.
Yeah. And there's storage strategy.
And probably change. Even just the way they manage the state's water project is probably going to change in future years. So all our underlying assumptions will have to be updated. You know, we can.
You're going to have a lot of functions there.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move forward. Any other questions, comments from the
directors? Just one quick question. Is this something the committee would like to see go to the board, or do you want to wait until we run through some of the additional kind of scenario?
Well, if you see that you have a presentation scheduled for March 7th.
Yeah. That's what I'm asking.
Okay.
It might be a little early for the board yet.
Yeah, I think we would need some more, visual kind of presentations for the rest of the board, maybe a screenshot of the, you know, of the functionality and, you know, how, you know, with arrows, you know, input, this is output in terms of a specific example, and obviously outputs. If you're not ready, yeah, absolutely, you know, push it back.
I think we'd, you know, it'd be great if we can run through some of the scenarios that we're thinking about that are, you know, starting to come into context. So,
I mean, you definitely made a case here for annual versus monthly. That was evident. Let's see some more examples of the benefit of Colson, if the committee agrees.
I don't think it's ready for the board yet. I mean, I wait a while till you have some actual data that you can run out on some of the simpler stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you for the input. Thank you,
Nadra. Thank you. All right. Let's move on to item 3.2, status of water supplies, presented by Sarah Flynn. Ms. Lurie, go ahead.
It's optimistic.
She's a lot more optimistic nowadays.
You know, I always compared the picture from last year where people were in shorts and measuring snowpack to last presentation where it was about, you know, skiing, snowboarding, pool suits. Oh, there we go. That's
what it should be.
Hey, are you, can you hear me and can you see my screen?
We can hear you. Can you press the volume just a little bit? The slurs when you say a sentence.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, this is good.
Okay. And you can see the title screen.
But no one's wearing shorts. You like that?
No one's wearing shorts. It's too much snow. So, and I hear you, Miss Optimistic now. I like that. I'll take that and run with it. Now I'm Miss Unsure. So good evening, everyone. I'm going to be doing another status of water supply updates for you. We're going to run through precipitation for the state snowpack and also local precipitation, look at some forecasts, talk about reservoir levels and allocation increase and operations that need to change or may change. I think some of you attended the Atmospheric River webinar that they had a couple weeks ago, and I thought this slide at the bottom right-hand corner was pretty cool. It was a great webinar, and they were talking about how 9 atmospheric rivers actually made landfall between December 26th and January 17th. The average for California each water year is about 6.5. So we got 9 in 3 weeks, which is pretty amazing. And then they also said that, hopefully I heard them correctly, but that they've only had 3 atmospheric rivers in the last 2 years previous to this. So hence some of the information you'll be seeing today. So to start out, we're going to look at the snowpack. And so on the left-hand side, you've got the bell curve showing us our historical average in the purple line, which shows us where we're at the current year to date. And so you can see we're very much higher above the April 1st peak than we need to be, which is great news. And on the right-hand side, the results of that snowpack, you can see from the Northern Sierra, Central and Southern Sierra, you've got greater than 150% numbers for this date. And then actually all of those areas are also over 100% for the April 1st average. So right now we have above average snowpack, even for the April 1st, and a lot more time to go. So hopefully we can hold those numbers at least, if not grow them. Who knows what could happen. Statewide precipitation, a similar story. On the left-hand side, you've got a bar graph. You can see the historical average line in red for this time of year and where we are at in the dark blue, quite a few inches above that. We're at about 145% of average precipitation to date and about 79% of the historical average for the end of the year. So we have a little ways to go there, but I'm not too concerned about that. On the right-hand side, you can see the majority of the precipitation and where it fell. Those purple areas are greater than 200%. And again, that was where the worst of the drought area was. So that's the most perfect place that it could have landed to improve our conditions. For Santa Clarita Valley, this is a precipitation graphic for us locally, and the information is taken from the Newhall Fire Station rain gauge. You can see the wettest year in blue, the average year in green, the driest year in red, last year in orange, so we were just a little below average, and then this year is currently in yellow, and I put it out to February. We really haven't had any precipitation yet in February, but, you know, again, we've got 3 more weeks to go. So it does look like a flat line right there, but it could go up depending on what we can get the next few weeks. But right now we're above our historical average, which is great. It's been a few years since we have had those kind of numbers. This is just a quick forecast for the state looking from February 6th to the 12th. There's really not a lot of precipitation that's lining up for our area. The Sierras are getting a little bit of precipitation in Northern California, which is it's good news. At least they're getting a little bit. There's not too much lining up with regards to atmospheric rivers for the next 16 days. So but that's okay. We've gotten 9. So, you know, maybe they need a little break for a little while. Temperature forecasts. On the left, you can see 8 to 14 day temperature outlook. And on the right, a 3 to 4 week temperature outlook. So kind of more short term. But on both of the graphics, you can see that California is kind of highlighted in blue colors. That tells us that it's the probability is going to be that we're likely below average temperatures for those time periods. And that's really good news because we have a ton of snow. We want it to stay as snow. We don't want it to melt and start running off in February. So that is a great temperature outlook for us for the next month. We like that. And so now we're going to transition into reservoir conditions. And I thought this was a good place to start. There was a really cool article a couple days ago in the Mercury News that was talking about Lake Oroville levels and comparing the lowest point, which was September of 2021, and that's that top row of pictures, to January 2023 after the storms, and just kind of showing how significant those storms impacted the reservoirs. Note that, you know, not everything came from those storms, a good majority did, but just kind of comparing the lowest point in Oroville a couple of years ago to now, it has come up a little bit over 180 feet since September of 2021, which is a pretty significant increase. So I thought those pictures were kind of fun to share. But I know you like graphics, so we'll get back to the bars and the line charts. On the left-hand side, you've got a bar chart, shows us kind of where we are with storage conditions in Lake Oroville currently. We are at about 67% of the total capacity, 113% of our historical average for this time of year. And on the right-hand side, what you see is just a comparison of our historical average there in light blue with a few different years highlighted here. So you've got the 2018-2019 water year in red. That year was a huge snow year for us. I believe the allocation was I think it was 85% that year. So it was a big year. We're tracking with that one, even ahead of it at this point in time. And then I threw in the 2020-2021 year in the light blue color, and then the 2021-2022 year, which was last year, in green. So you can see that at this point in time, we're above the historical average. We're doing much better than the last 2 years. Only good news to share on this graphic. Next, we'll go to San Luis Reservoir. Same bar graph. You can see we're a little bit below the historical average for this time, for this date, but we are at 67% of total capacity. On the right-hand side, we have that comparison of those same years. So 2018, 2019 in red. I do believe we had a spill that year. And then the last 2 years in the light blue and the green. And where we are today is that darker blue line. So we are filling that reservoir quickly and taking as much water to export as we can, which is great news as well. I wanted to dive a little bit deeper with regards to the San Luis Reservoir. So this is another graphic which splits up the shares between DWR and the Bureau of Reclamation. So the San Luis Reservoir is basically split 50-50 between the state's share, and then the Bureau of Reclamation share. And so the state share is in the dark blue, the Bureau is in the light blue. So you can see both of those totals are increasing at this time a bit, as much as possible. And then you've got two dotted lines here. The first one shows us where DWR's capacity ends. So when that dark blue line hits that first dotted red line, that's where we hit our capacity, about a little over 1 million acre feet. And then the light blue actually has the second half of the reservoir. So they'd go up just a little over 2 million acre feet, but it's about a 50-50 split. Currently, DWR share, and this was as of, I guess, 4 days ago when I did this, when I updated this, or the most recent number was around 820,000 acre feet. It's probably, I think they've been filling it about 10 to 15,000 acre feet a day. So it's probably about maybe 40,000 acre feet, at least higher than that number right now. Our share in this dark blue section for our carryover storage is about 17,000 acre feet at this point. That's a combination of our carryover and our backed up supplies. With regards to this reservoir, we're monitoring it really closely because they're filling it really fast. So we're aware that there is some spill potential. I am having some challenges with just finalizing deliveries in 2022. Other agencies that are reporting have had some staffing issues. So we're working pretty hard to get some accurate numbers with regards to our carryover supplies. The 17,000 acre feet is actually a number that I believe is there. DWR is reporting less than that. So I'm working on that issue as much as I can. And I'll keep you posted on what happens with that. But we've got a good supply there for use next year. I'm sure that all of you have heard about the allocation increase. So we started at a 5% allocation. In January, we were bumped up to 30%. I do believe, based on the studies I've seen, that the number will continue to increase, but it hasn't quite yet. So knowing that, we're kind of in this place where we are walking a fine line between water management and flood control. It's a little tippy either way, just, you know, kind of patiently waiting. So what we're doing right now with regards to our operations is we're looking at a potential shift locally. If we do get a lot more imported supplies, that's kind of when we start maximizing the use of those surface water supplies, backing off and conjunctively using our local groundwater supplies. So we back off, let that aquifer recharge. And we're also seeing quite a bit of demand decrease. It's a combination of all of the conservation we've been pushing, but also because we got so much precipitation in December and January, we've not got a lot of demand right now. So Matt will probably have some really good information to share with you. So we're aware of that as well. With regards to our imported supply, we're looking at that potential carryover spill, trying to avoid it as much as possible, evaluating the need for bank supplies this year now with that allocation change. And then we're looking, actually, I started talking to other partners to see if they're going to be ready to switch to recharge opportunities if that allocation continues to increase. So those are some of the things that we're looking into, and we will dive in a little deeper with your favorite table, the operating plan scenarios. So what I have shown here in this table is the most updated operating plan that we've been working on. I've grayed out that 5% allocation, hoping that it won't come back this year. And so we are currently at the 30% allocation line. One of the big changes, well, one of the changes in this is that you can see the demand has shifted down. So when we started putting numbers together for 2023, we're utilizing different sources like the urban plan, looking at last year's demands, things like that, to kind of come up with where we would fall with regards to our overall demand. In a 5% allocation and severe drought, customers tend to use more water. And knowing that we've had a lot of precipitation locally, we now have some surface water supplies available. We're seeing demands decrease in our service area. We bumped that down a little bit to just try to be a bit more accurate with regards to the demands. I have, if you kind of scroll down, we've got the same amount of groundwater supplies available as we did at the 5% allocation. Our imported demands are a little less because our overall demands decreased. Let me back up one second. One of the things that we are talking to with operations again is to try to maximize that surface water supply. Let me see if my mouse will work here. We're going to try to maximize our surface water supplies here. And so these numbers, we're looking at decreasing these numbers, but we just started working with operations to get those. So most likely you'll see some changes by the next update. But right now we're keeping those the same and kind of waiting patiently. You've got our Table A allocation that's gone up to 30%, our Buena Vista, Rosedale, Rio Bravo, 11,000 acre feet. And so we have gone from 31,000 acre feet of shortage to now about only 4,500 acre feet of shortage. That has allowed us to basically reduce any of our bank supply. I don't think we need to pull water from our bank supplies at this point at a 30% allocation. We have a healthy carryover supply that can help us work through. The Yuba Accord water will be available as long as the allocation stays around 30%. Once it gets higher, that will disappear because the ability to transfer water through the Delta kind of closes up. We are still operating at a tier two water shortage contingency plan regulations until the state makes shifts those requirements. You know, we are still in that status for conservation. And so our updated operating plan, you know, if things are perfect, as they never are, is showing that we'll have a very healthy supply of carryover around 24,000 acre feet by the end of the year. Now, nothing is ever final. And that's kind of all I can say. This is changing daily at this point. But I've also added a 50% allocation scenario and a 75% allocation scenario. If we go up from 30%, we're going to quickly transition into putting water back into our banking facilities. You know, we're always shooting for that final carryover of 10 to 20,000 acre feet. And that's what Najwa's Goldson model will help me kind of narrow that down. We want to find that sweet spot. And so, you know, we have a little water to play with at that point. Definitely going to try to put water back in the banking facilities first. That's our goal. And that's about it. Plans are things that change. So as long as you're okay with change, then we're good to go.
Thank you, Ms. Laura. Before we open up to directors, any questions from the public?
There is none.
All right, directors, questions, comments?
Comments? Oftentimes during the spring, the water supply that they're able to get out of the Delta is constrained because of the Old Middle River restrictions. But with the extremely healthy snowpack in the San Joaquin Basin, it would appear that might be able to bypass some of that. So I was curious if DWR or anyone has come up with projections of San Joaquin River flows and how that may impact the rate that we see San Joaquin.
The San Joaquin flows have been huge. And so I do think that that's been helping with how much water they've been able to export. Those flows are going down pretty quickly these days. So I think they're starting to get to that point where I mean, I haven't heard any projections with what's going to happen with that yet. I know Zach from Rosedale said that the Frank Canal is open again, so that may impact those flows because they'll be taking more water that they weren't able to before, if I understand that correctly. But we have an operations meeting next week. So at the last operations meeting, they weren't, let's just say, they gave us some good information, but they weren't ready to share, you know, information about San Luis spilling, any projections like that. They said there are some constraints that they're dealing with because there's so much water in the system, but they're pulling as much as they can. So I'm hoping that at the next operations meeting, they'll dive into a bit more detail, because in January, they didn't have the February 1st snowpack information included in any of their modeling assumptions. So kind of one more week and hopefully we'll know more.
Thank you.
Dr. Cooper.
Sarah, you said, according to your numbers, what are your expectations in March when they give us a new number? What do you see?
I what does my crystal ball see?
40?
I'm unsure. I think, you know, the numbers that they shared at the operations meeting were really positive, like anywhere from 50% to in the 70s. And again, that was only based on precipitation that they had in January. So they didn't have all that snow that we got that beginning of January. So I think it's going to get much higher, but I also know that DWR could be conservative. So I think they gave us an allocation of 30% now, because that will help alleviate all the contractors that were pulling health and safety water. So with that 30% allocation, now health and safety water is off the table, which I think alleviates a lot of conflicts, let's just say. But I don't, you know, I think the snow is going to make a big impact. There's a lot of it, and I see it going pretty high. So I think we are going to go from pretty dry to pretty high. But again, my crystal ball doesn't work that well. So who knows? I'm also prepared for anything at this point. You know, it's kind of a wait and see game at right now. I think in a month, we're going to have a lot more information.
Well, 70 would be fantastic. We could get some water back into the ground, and that would be wonderful.
Yes. Mr. Martin?
Sarah, thank you for your presentation. Could you explain, I know you said one of the objectives is to avoid spill. How do we avoid spill?
I'm working on that as much as I can. And I'm finding there's the main way to avoid spill is to use the water that we have in San Luis. There's not a lot of other ways to avoid the spill. So that's one of the strategies right now with us trying to work with operations. If we can back off on some of our local groundwater production, that would allow us to utilize more imported supplies in the winter. But unfortunately, in the winter, we just don't have the demands to use all of that water. So it's kind of, we can do as much as we can, but we are also constrained a bit with regards to, one, how much can we lower those groundwater wells? Because now there's a lot of wells with treatment that need to be run at a specific rate. There's water quality that needs to be maintained. And so you have to continue running the wells. From preliminary work with operations, I think we can make a significant dent and back off. Is that all going to happen in the next month? Probably not. So I think overall, we are going to be able to utilize a lot of our imported supplies, but I don't know if it's going to really make a dent in this carryover, you know. But I think the good thing to recognize is that when we do have a spill, if for say we spill like 15,000 acre feet, we're going to get a really big allocation, I'd assume. And at this point, any allocation, even that 50%, lands us in a place where we're putting almost all of the water we can in our banking facilities and still coming out with 24,000 acre feet of carryover for next year. So we're not losing any overall. We're kind of maintaining that space.
So, Sarah, just a couple things on, we have made operational choices, right, to try and lessen the risk, right? And those are banking. We're not pulling anything from the banks.
We're not pulling anything at the banks right now. Yeah, we're not pulling anything at the banks. The only water we're importing right now is our carryover supplies.
So we've totally...
We've stopped all banking deliveries in January.
And we made it early, thanks to Sarah, right? We did not pull anything from the banks, even though we were planning to in January. So we did not do that. And another one is we've got a little room for making up flexible storage in Castaic Lake. So that's some of the accounting that Sarah was talking about, was to try and figure out those numbers.
And they've said they're gonna backfill that from our 2022 deliveries. So the 17,000 acre feet is representative of flex being full at the beginning of this year. And then some of the contract things that I'm finding out, you know, as I try to move the water as quickly as I can anywhere else, I'm finding that really, I think the contract limits us to only being able to deliver table A water to our banking facilities. So carryover is not really an option to put in the bank, but I'm going to reach out to DWR contract sections and just verify that officially, but from talking to Semi-Tropic, it doesn't look positive. Let's just say that.
So we can't move this water to Castaic. Is that right?
Nope. We don't have any space in Castaic available to our agency there.
Yeah. DWR is just going to fill up the holes that they created. And, good.
Understood. Ms. Flory, on slide 2, you showed a diagram from center of Western weather and water extremes. That's been developed by Dr. Amari from UCSD. Have you had a chance to also participate in that Southern California Water Dialogue webinar?
Yes, I did.
Okay. In it, Dr. Marty mentioned that his forecast, his 17 forecast for atmospheric rivers is really reliable. I was really impressed how his forecast matched observed conditions. Do you see, would it be helpful for us to see these forecasts in the month of November, December, January, and February during these committee meetings? Just one slide showing anticipate 7-day forecast for atmospheric river conditions.
I think the big impact for us, I keep an eye on that stuff, so I'm looking at those forecasts pretty frequently. The big impact for our area is really with regards to Castaic Lake, and it has a real big impact when we get atmospheric rivers. It's impacted our turbidity levels in Castaic Lake, which is actually a bit of a constraint with regards to pulling water into our treatment facilities, because generally our treatment facilities are pulling very minimally turbid water. And so when the water gets really mucky from these storms and a lot of mud running off down the watershed, it slows our treatment plants down quite a bit. And so actually they had to turn our water treatment plants off. They said about up to 2 weeks during January because of the turbidity levels in the lake. So I know our operations team is kind of monitoring that stuff. Otherwise, the atmospheric rivers, you know, they're pushing snow. I don't know if it would do anything for us locally, kind of short term with regards to our operations, that I could see changing at this point.
Right, right. I mean, I know you look at it and, you know, you... I guess we they will base their operations based on those forecasts. I think it was just a really cool, and again, you know, we meet once a month here and with board meetings, you know, twice a month. And since this forecast is only good for 7 days, you know, it's not really going to tell us anything of importance, but I don't know, just a quick for thought. I'll email you exactly what I would like to see. But it's up to you and the water resources team to see whether it's even applicable during, you know, during your presentations.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions, comments from directors? Thank you, Ms. Optimistic, sorry. Great presentation. Looking forward to 70% or else.
Gosh, don't hold me to that number. Or less. Thank you.
All right, we'll move on to item 3.3, staff activities, presented by Mr. Al-San.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening, committee members. And thank you to Najwa, who is leaving now because we have a long drive. And thanks to Sarah for doing the presentations. I think I just wanted to make sure that the committee, and probably you have seen the complexity of the issues that both of them are dealing. In the long term, when we are looking at the work that Najwa is doing, it's a long-term planning for us. While for Sarah is the short term, and there is a lot of things that beyond our control, we don't have any good handle of them. And a lot of it is even the simple issue like the turbidity. You know, we have more water coming to us, but we cannot use it because it's so turbid. And so these are things that I really appreciate that the staff are doing this work. They are really dedicating a lot of time to do this work so that they can be nimble in making change and also understanding of all of these complexity that this dynamic system is really complex. With that, I would like to share with you a couple of coordinations with other agencies while you are having this situation of the how to manage this dynamic system, how to avoid the spills, how we can move water and bring it here so that we can do all of that. And some of these are I talked about it before, but one of the things I just wanted to mention to you today is we had a meeting on January 19th with Five Point. And that's the first time I was introduced. Steve and I went and met with some of their staff. Steve introduced me to the staff and we had just a general discussion about to continue developing a framework for collaboration and coordination moving forward with some of the issues between the two parties. Internally, staff is, and actually this is an effort that Steve has been leading before I joined here, and we are continuing working on that, is developing an internal plan to work with Five Points to advance topics in the agreements as we have it right now. So this is a work that to be continued, and hopefully we're planning, hope is not a plan, we're planning to come back to the committee with some issues to discuss and get guidance on how to approach some of these issues in the future meetings. The second meeting that we had a meeting with High Desert Water Bank Phase 2, and I think General Manager Stone yesterday mentioned that in his report. It was General Manager Stone, Steve, and myself who went and met with EVAC. EVAC sat down with us and went through their vision. Actually, it's not a concrete thing yet, but it's a vision and a draft MOU term sheet regarding the participation in the banking operation Phase 2 project. So they're calling it Phase 2 project. So we, as staff, when we came back, we felt that was a very good meeting. They presented a lot of good information for us. And we requested additional information from them, and we are currently reviewing the information they provided to us. So we are planning to send back our comments and questions for them because we already started finding some questions on the draft sheet that they provided and their vision. So we are asking some questions and hopefully we'll get back some answers before we come back to the committee with kind of the draft on the MOU so that you can give us your guidance on how to approach this. It's important to note a couple of things. EVAC is in the process of finishing construction of Phase 1. which is mainly targeted toward MET. And so there is a lot of, they're getting a lot of information, actual data from building the system and all of that. And so they are learning a lot. So it's a very good learning process for them. And that's how they are now putting that into the vision of phase two. So a couple of years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, they provided a vision. I think they are refining a lot of that vision based on the construction of phase one. So I think it's a good advantage for us to be in phase two as we are getting more information and good information from them on how to, you know, the construction and design and all of that information, so it can help us in making decisions about this program in the future. And as Nigel mentioned, this is, could be one of the case studies that we can have and test with the new reliability model and see adding that to our portfolio, if that's going to make any difference or improvement in our reliability for our portfolio. One of the other things I just wanted to mention quickly here is state water contractors engagement. And I know that, as example, President Martin, you are engaged with the Delta Conveyance Design and Construction Authority. So you sit in those meetings. And I know that many other staff within the agency are engaged in different committees. And probably I will come back maybe next month or a month after. I just wanted to share this quickly. This is kind of, I'm trying to put my head around who is involved in the agency in which committee within the state water contractors. And thanks to Director Marks, who helped me a lot, and General Manager Stone, who have been sitting in a lot of these meetings. It's just, it's unbelievable how many staff are engaged in different ad hoc or standing committees that the state water project is doing. And so one of the things that we, one of the things I'm trying to work with Steve and General Manager Stone is to create an internal team that can coordinate all of this staff work with regard to the state water projects. I think there will be a great benefit for staff to share information, to have a venue where they can share information about the state water project and just update each other about what's happening. And then that will be translated into information that's presented to the board in making decisions in the future. And hopefully this will be the target of us having this internal meeting. Our first meeting is going to be in March 7th. So we are inviting people who are sitting in all of these different places representing our agency. And hopefully this will create an advantage for us in understanding how the state water project works. The other thing that, and I think Sarah has mentioned this, we have a coordination, monthly coordination meetings with Rosedale and Irvine Ranch. We had one in February 1st, actually. And actually, those coordination meetings became very important now because of the dynamic of the system. We wanted to know their operations. Sarah is in continuous coordination with their staff about water orders and how to move water and things like that. So she made the decision of stopping water from the banks early in January. And so that was a great decision because they already stopped pumping, actually, from any, because no one is requesting water from them. So we continue those coordination meetings regarding the banking operations. And considering also these challenges of new allocations coming to us, we have 30% now in the state of the 5%. So we need to make sure that we have a better understanding of the operations of the bank and also looking into some possibilities and potential for ability to put water in the bank if that become available and that becomes something. One of the things that we have done, and Sarah did a great job in a recent meeting with them, we presented to those partners, especially they have new staff that they don't know a lot about our organization. We presented to them about our portfolio and some of our operations, how we are managing our banks and what infrastructure we're using to move water and so on. And that was really helpful for them to enhance their understanding of what we do and how, when we are requesting things, they can understand that. They are doing the same thing because we have new staff in this organization, also myself. And so they are sharing their operations, their infrastructure plans with us. in the next couple of meetings. One of the things that we realized with the partners in this group that we wanted to have more frequent meetings because of the situation with the State Water Project. That's, we might have more allocations, and so we wanted to be on top of if we become at 75%, what we if then how quickly the bank can take water and put it in the ground if that's a decision that we make in the organization. The last thing I would like to address today in my report is I talked last time in my report last month about United Release Agreement. That's the long-term agreement that we have been reviewing. We sent our comments regarding the agreement to United, and United have been going through it. They didn't mention that they have a lot of comments on it, and they are moving it to their board for approval, hopefully this month. And I think that's really good news that they are trying to move it as quickly as possible. And we are planning, I'm not going to say we're hoping, we're planning to bring it to the committee in the next month meeting. And if everything goes as planned, which is could not happen. And this is mainly for the long-term available water supplies that they wanted to release, such as Article 21, if become available, they wanted to do that. And this is the agreement we want. But one of the things interestingly happening in the recent days, and probably you have heard about it, that the Department of Water Resources has estimated that there is 25,000 acre feet of flood flows have been stored in Castaic Lake because of the January storms. And United, acting as the representative of the downstream water users, requested this water to be stored before each storm. I think they have an agreement in 1978. And to assure that all this stored water will benefit the downstream basins, United requested that the DWR start releasing this flow. So if you go to the river, now there is some water coming from Castaic Lake going into United. My understanding, speaking to Steve today, that flow, that storage flow increased to 35,000. So United is requesting more water to be released now. They requested, I think, starting in February 2nd, about 200 cubic feet per second. I think they're increasing that. They're asking to increase that to 300 cubic feet per second. And when I look at...
It's been a long time since we've seen that.
Actually, they were saying that this is the first time in... Since they have the agreement for 5 years, that this is the first time they're doing it.
Now we have some flood flow there, too. I mean,
right.
Valencia had rights to flood flow...
The farm aspect did, yeah. So it's a four-party agreement. It's United, New Hall County Water District,
right.
New Hall Land and Farming, and the county through the sheriff's department for their well field. So that's that long-standing agreement that Ali mentioned. So that goes back to when they put the dam in, essentially, and then it got amended a few times. One of those amendments allowed for the storage of the water, which was pretty unique in the reservoir. And so what the management philosophy has been on that, at least in the recent history when we have the water, is to go ahead and store it, not release it when it's raining out, because you're just putting 200 CFS or whatever else is coming into the river, right? And it's going to go to the ocean. So the idea is store it, but there's a limitation on how long you can store it. So it's all got to be out by May 1st.
May 1st.
Yeah. So that's the timing of and the amount of why they're asking to release at the level that they are, so that they vacate all that water. Otherwise, DWR kind of hangs on to that, and it just disappears into the accounting of water. It'd
be interesting to see what kind of benefit we get out of this release on our east end of the basin, or does it just all spill? I mean,
I think, Director Cooper, you are really leading to my last point here about the release. I think this is a really good segue to what I'm going to say here. It's, we are interested in this flood flow release because United will measure flow following the same draft procedure that they put into the long-term agreement that we are reviewing with them and they're reviewing now. So this is a really good opportunity. Our staff will be engaged with them to see how the procedure works, how the measurement works, and then if there is any need for amendments of the long-term flow agreement measurements, we're going to do it as we are learning from this, following this current flow measurements that they're doing right now. So we are, I think Sarah is in communication with them just to follow up on how they're doing the measurements and understanding more about the protocol that they're putting in the agreement so that we can make sure that it's going to be really serving us and serving them for the benefit of both of us. With that, Mr. Chair, this is the end of my report.
Thank you. Very good. Is getting any questions?
No.
Okay, Director Marks.
There an estimate as to when the flood flows will be evacuated from the reservoir? That's right. And do we think it's going to, I guess my question is, do we think that water will be evacuated prior to Article 21 becoming available?
I would check with United on that, Director Marks, and I will get back to you. I don't have the answer for that question at this point, but this is really a great question to ask them.
I guess my follow-on comment to that is the potential exists for Article 21 water to become available prior to next month's Water Resources meeting and a subsequent board meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So staff may want to consider temporary actions maybe that the general manager could take under his authority over maybe getting, if you need new authority or additional authority, getting that.
Mm-hmm.
Early, so we don't miss the opportunity to manage and get some sort of benefit out of the article.
And that's a really good point that we will we'll get back with Steve and General Manager Stone to see the potential for us having a temporary authority that we can start using Article 21 when it becomes available.
Yeah. Thank you.
Injured. That's 2 months worth of work. Questions, comments from directors? Just a quick question. So United's going to do the measurement. Are we going to assist in that in any way or no?
That's what we've asked to do.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah.
And they are open to it. Mm-hmm. Saying there is correspondence from them, it seems they are open for us to come and observe and help with that.
I see on the agenda, on the calendar agenda, that we're going to discuss Devil's Den at March 8th committee meeting. Are we expected to hear anything back from Provost and Pritchard and Thomas Farder and company?
I think you'll get a general update. It won't be anything final.
Okay.
We're reviewing a draft report. We've asked them to do a little bit more work to make sure that it's comprehensive, and so we'll give an update on that.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Hassan. All right, item 4.1, we've decided to move that to the next agenda just because of the previous topics being so much in priority and the expected time to go through them. So we're going to skip 4.1, move that to the next committee meeting, and go to item 4.2. Presentation of completed water conservation and education experience design presented by Mr. Matt Dickens. Mr. Dickens, go ahead.
Hello, good evening. Thank you, Chair Ozerhosky and members of the members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we are. Let's begin.
All right, let me share my screen here. Okay, you should be able to see my screen now.
Yes.
Yes, we can.
All right. So thank you again. I'm Matt Dickens, a sustainability manager, and I'm here tonight to provide an update on the water conservation garden education experience, the design completion check-in. While I do have some great information to share, it's not specific to our drought performance in January. It's rather the overview and the completion of this project, which has been in the queue since before the agency merged in 2018. So we're very excited to be here tonight. All right, so our design review objectives include an overview of water conservation garden education experience project, a review of the completed exhibit design concepts to demonstrate the 3D garden model, inform on engineering cost estimates, and then elicit feedback from the members of the committee. The milestones include a project overview, the evolution of the garden design concepts, the completed water conservation garden education experience site design, completed exhibit designs, the 3D model demonstration, engineering cost estimates, and discussion. All right, so diving right into the project overview, turning to the SCV Water 2019 strategic, 5-year strategic plan, we can see here that goal A was the customer community implement policies supporting the social quality of life and environmental values of the community. Specifically, let's turn to A2, which is proactively communicate with and engage our community on water matters of importance in the region, positioning SCV Water as a leading resource and reliable authority on water issues. And then that distills down to A26, which is raise awareness of and demand for conservation programs through water conservation campaigns and related media buys, public and school education programs, participation in public events, SCV Water website, E's newsletter and social media, self-guided landscape tour, and the conservatory garden. So this project is in line and supported with our 2019 strategic plan. Real quickly, I want to say my share my thanks and appreciation for our design team, which included myself, Julia Groth, our consultants with ECG, Sal, folks from ECG, as well as Pacific Coast Landscaping Design. But the collaboration and the input and the feedback and the partnership with the agency and other designers is fairly robust. And I do want to again give a shout out to those folks who were part of the landscape or the garden conservatory review refurbishment project prior to the agency. They did some great work trying to identify some options and opportunities. We picked up when the agency merged, met with the SCV Water Resources Committee and Board of Directors. We met with staff, including our educators, and reviewing their award-winning education program, our communications team, sustainability, engineering, water resources, administration. And we even worked with a world-leading exhibit designer, Tom Bowman with Bowman Change. So quite a robust group of folks to develop this design and these plans. So turning to the mission specific to this project, our mission was to educate the public on the value of water, and that's the mission as we propose it for this facility, the Conservatory Garden Education Experience. And our vision is creating a sustainable public spaces for educational, inspirational, and demonstration purposes pertaining to the values and beneficial uses of water throughout the Santa Clarita Valley. And again, there was a Legacy Conservatory Garden Task Force. There was a CONGA tag, which was the Conservatory Garden Technical Advisory Group. It includes state water project and local aquifer exhibit designs and state-of-the-art conservation garden education experience with the design team. What I do want to note is that this facility, and I'll talk more about this, and I'll talk about it now, benefits to the agency and the community include, what the park is it supports our best-in-class education programs. We have award-winning child education programs that get from 12 to 14,000 children per year visiting the garden facilities. Prior to COVID, we did. We have adult education programs and classes that are held there. A water academy is going to be held there shortly. We have staff training. We have quite a bit of opportunity in the space that's not been used. So it's important to note that what the garden is and what the water conservatory garden is not. It's not a water park. It is a water conservatory garden, a learning lab, and an education experience. So it brings those two things together to prioritize the education of our youth, our future water leaders, our parents, our homeowners, our property managers, our landscape contractors, you name it. We're looking for a space to be able to work with them on salient water issues specific to the Valley and our water agency. We do have a mixture of curriculum salient water efficient plants. The garden includes mostly native and water efficient California native and low water use plants. It uses high efficiency irrigation technologies. It meets and exceeds the model water efficient landscape ordinance of the 2018 version, which is a roughly a 0.45 evapotranspiration adjustment factor. And I want to say this one was down to 0.3 something. So it's state of the art and will be for quite some time. And of course, again, it has education exhibits with global, state, and local water perspectives. We do envision in the design enhances facilities that enhance education, training, and event spaces, including the garden pavilion, sustainability shack, shade sales, and continued use of our amphitheater. All right, so turning to the evolution of the design, here we can see kind of what the, for this topo map, we can see what the current conservatory garden looks like. It has these four quadrants and this entrance kind of garden, and then there's a lot of open space. Currently, you can see here where the globe is, where the center where those palm trees are. We initially said, hey, let's use the amphitheater, redesign the landscape, put a sustainability and shack in, move it down, create a pavilion and event space here, and then maybe kind of resize this and right size the garden to remove these quads, quad three and quad four, so that we can get a smaller, more agile, but really functional space in the garden. So our first concept, if you recall, this was presented, I want to say about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. We were still kind of utilizing this symmetrical quadrant kind of style, but was starting to bring in exhibits. We developed the master plan of multiple exhibits. You've got, again, the globe here with global water issues, a state water project map of the state, which can talk and discuss about state water project issues, hydrology, state hydrology, water footprint, and then you've got local issues here. So it kind of flows nicely from global to state to local. And then we kind of envision the facility down here. But as we continued to move forward with our design team, we wanted to move away from the symmetrical design and create something that was more engaging throughout the garden, where you could, when while you're working or walking through the garden, you became immersed in the experience, where there would be discovery and at various different components. So with that, we had learning gardens, exhibits, state water project exhibits or state water exhibits and local water exhibits, the amphitheater, urban forest exhibit, and facilities and types of plants that we could use to work with our adults to train on our pruning and sustainable landscapes. All of that led to the project overview, which is, this is kind of a better representation of what the garden looks like in its current, the design of the garden's current status. So as you can see, we did move away from the symmetrical designs. You have more of a flow, more of an immersive experience where while you're walking through the garden, there's lots of places to explore, discover, learn about water, have classes, have access to power. We incorporated shade sales, again, a sustainability shack and lots of different features. So there's multiple purposes here to use for child education, adult education, staff training, professional industry training, events, and whatnot. So in addition to that, we re-landscaped and incorporated state-of-the-art high-efficiency irrigation and far more native water-efficient plant palette. In terms of the State Water Project exhibit, I've shared this with the group before, but just as a refresher, this is a model scale of the state of California. It incorporates basically a model replica of the State Water Project system, which can be used by operators to work with lights and water to actually move water through the state, down through the Central Valley, and then up to Southern California. And it uses a very simple mechanism, sprinkler valves and other types of technologies to essentially move water. We can create different hydrologic cycles. We can show the students to, what's happening in the reservoir conditions when there's surplus of water, flooding, those types of things, and what happens to the State Water Project system and reservoirs when there's drought. So it's a very interactive model with lots of things to, become immersive in, to engage with, and to see how the system moves water from Northern California to the south for the State Water Project system. The local aquifer exhibit, again, this design has been completed. And what it does is that if you could imagine, this is the surface level of the Santa Clarita Valley. And it basically takes this slice of earth and moves it up so that students and learners can peer into the aquifer system. We use lacquer and other types of clear lacquer to show what we know to be as accurate as geology underneath the ground. They can see where they are. Look how the aquifer matches with the both the alluvium and the deep Saugus aquifers and other geologic features in here. So when we talk about an aquifer, when we talk about how our community is built on water, this exhibit shows exactly that so that people can peer what I think a lot of us want to do, which is show what an aquifer looks like as opposed to porous sand and rocks, which eventually, it is, but also it's far more robust than that and dynamic than that. So this is a really cool exhibit to help our residents and our learners learn about aquifers, specifically our aquifer systems here in the valley. This I'm going to show here is a 3D model. It's a flyover of the garden. Essentially, if we were to design and build this garden in alignment with the design concept, right now we're flying over the the garden pavilion. You can see the shade sails, and our design team put them in the colors of the water agency. The shade sails would make the garden more functional during hot weather temperature, as well as protect the exhibits underneath. Now we're kind of flying over near the urban forest area. There's the amphitheater that I'm sure most of us are aware of. Really nice organic pathways, matching pathways. Now we're going to fly down to see the exhibit view. So now we're at the globe, we're coming into the State Water Project system, the exhibit. This exhibit is called Where Your Water Comes From. And this is just a model of what it might look like, although there's more features to what the actual exhibit would include. This is a very large shade structure here, the pavilion, which could house agency events, larger classes, other types of events, trainings. There's the local aquifer exhibit. A small sustainability shack, which we envision and our teachers recommended teaching things like fogs, fat oils and greases, composting, rain barrel, rainwater harvesting, those types of components. You may know we've got two pieces of pipe down in the garden currently. We would repurpose those in the garden. One of them can be used for pathway purposes. The other one is too small. You can't walk through it. It doesn't meet the criteria for ADA compliance. It's just a really great garden space, a really innovative, state-of-the-art, exciting design that, again, takes information from the committee, the board, management, teachers, our design exhibit, our exhibit developers, as well as our site designers. Okay. Okay, so now let's turn to engineering cost estimates. So in March 2022, I provided an update to the committee that essentially showed our hardscape landscapes and structures estimated about $1.8 million. I believe this was a 25% cost estimate. Our exhibits around $600,000. Shade structures, we had $800,000 or using shade trees. The total cost estimate at that point in time was roughly about $3.2 to $3.5 million. Turning to our 100% opinion of probable costs, our construction for the garden is about $1.769 million. The exhibits come in at $525,000, although that market may have changed considering when those estimates were created. So that's a very good estimate, but the market has certainly changed after COVID, so it's something to reevaluate. Structures and shading options, roughly about $992,000. That's for the garden pavilion, sustainability shack, and shade sales. And then this does include a contingency of 10% and a CPI of 2% for 3 years at $550K for a total opinion of probable cost at $3.837 million. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or comments, but also to, at this point, to engage with the committee to kind of determine next steps. I did not incorporate a matrix in the presentation, although I did put together something to kind of look at some various different options of what we might expect or what we might want to consider. But this is just to frame the discussion, certainly not to incorporate all the options. But in the discussion option matrix, I look at four different options. We've got full project construction, RFP. That would include all the garden exhibits. That's the $3.837 million. We could do a partial construction of the RFP. That would not include any shade structures or facilities. So that's about $2 million. That's all plants, all garden, pavers, irrigation, electric, potable water, those types of components. We could hold and pursue grant funding. That would, you know, we would seek grant funding for all garden exhibits. The cost is about $3.8 million plus cost increases minus the grant award. And then perhaps an alternative short-term solution might be something like a small refurbishment project just to enable the increased utility of that space, which right now I can say is been used at a minimum for many reasons. And this goes back to our initial discussion. The facility built in the early 90s has a lot of structural integrity issues that are just not safe within the garden. There's walls that are crumbling at the foundation from erosion and those types of things. So there are some areas that we can and the teachers do use, but the bulk of that area is not really ideal for having folks wandering around at this time. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or engage with the committee for discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jenkins. Before we ask our questions, any comments from the public? Directors, comments, questions? President Martin.
Yeah. Matt, thank you for your presentation. I know I haven't seen this before. I haven't seen this level of detail before on this proposed project. Where are you on the design? Is this still concept level work?
This is 100% completion.
This is 100% completion. Okay, so basically you have plan specifications ready to go.
That's correct.
And what is the construction schedule look like?
That's a great point. We haven't gone to RFP or construction bid. We wanted to check in with the committee before pursuing that next step. But it would, ideally, if construction were to start, it would be 60 to 90 days before mobilization or the RFP was done, mobilization occurs. And then we're looking at construction, to about 12 to 18 months.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions, comments from directors? Dr. Marks?
Matt, you mentioned that because we had about 14,000 students in the education program, a high percentage of those physically came up to where we have stuck. Do we know what our current utilization of Rio Vista is for our education program? Is it 5,000? Is it 7,000? Or could we find that out?
Yeah, well, we can find that out, Director Marks. I appreciate the question. I know that they've recently started having in-person visitations at the garden recently. So, you know, it's going to grow. They're starting to return to some operations of bringing kids up to the garden. But I don't believe that it's at full throttle.
Yeah, to try to better understand the benefit, you know, in a sense of the benefit that can be realized. Education program being certainly one of those. I'm not quite sure how to quantify broader community engagement other than our curriculum.
Oh, and in terms of like a cost benefit analysis?
I don't know that you can put a dollar amount on the benefits necessarily, but some numbers of what we would expect as far as public events or you know, numbers of people that we would have up using the garden and seeing the exhibits.
The Director Marks, that's a great question. And I think there's two pieces to that, right? One is, what is the value of the impact of the education to young people and their interaction with water, which clearly there's going to be a lifelong impact. It's like priceless, but also, you know, hard to quantify, 5% of their lifetime usage. The second piece would be like a dollar per person kind of estimate. And so if we were running full throttle, and we took those numbers and kind of ran an escalation, you're probably looking at $10 to $15 per student per visit over the useful life of the garden over time. I mean, that's one way to do that estimation.
Yeah. Mr. Dickens, could we use this space as an event space for the private sector? Being rented out to private companies for events? Is that a possibility? Do we have the parking facilities to do that?
Director Ozerhosky, it's a great question. I'd have to check in on historical practice. I believe that historically it was used as an event space. You know, that certainly has changed since 9/11 and security protocols. But, you know, people would be able to visit the space during regular business hours. And the agency would have access to it and its leader.
So, Mr. Dickens, I know Santa Clara is famous for nonprofit galas, events. And I can think of two organizations that would be willing to, you know, host events in that space. But, you know, that would have to be quantified because we're looking at $3.8 million plus. What's the yearly maintenance on this, $500,000?
It'd be very similar to the current maintenance costs of maintaining the garden, although there probably would be some escalation too. I'd have to find that out. I mean, currently we have landscapers that are essentially, you know, making sure the irrigation clocks are operating, the irrigation is turning on and off. And when a plant dies, I believe they put society garlic in there. So if you go up there, there's a ton of society garlic. That's the thing that thrives, and that's, you know, that's another big issue about this, is that this garden, and I didn't mention this, but this garden does incorporate some very, you know, innovative BMPs for stormwater management. There's a dry well, use of a dry well. So we're trying to deal with drainage, which that soil in that location is really not ideal for drainage. And that's been one of the big issues and concerns. But this plan includes quite a bit of civil grading work that moves water into the dry well. So we think that that's a good mitigation strategy for that.
Dr. Cooper.
Yeah, I guess kind of hard. I'm not quite sure where to begin on this. We've got a great education program, and we have a lot of kids that come up. I'm not sure, and the displays that you've got planned, I think, are excellent. I think that's great. The kids' program. But that doesn't have to have a park to put it in. I mean, it could be put up on the patio. You know, there's lots of places to do it. The value of the park when we first put it in back in the 90s was we did public events. In fact, my daughter was married in the park.
Oh.
When we first did it. It was the first wedding. And we had several weddings down there. And we rented it out. It became, and then 9/11 hit. And then we had to lock everything down. But it became to the point where one of the employees, Karen Dakinger, was working as a
wedding planner.
A wedding planner. and dealing with the brides and the mothers. And it became a big job. She had some, because we had other weddings that were there, not just new. We had Taste of the Town there a couple of years. There were several events that we had down there. I think even John Boston used to come out and do at the amphitheater. He would do historical talks at night. It got a lot of play. Now I'm concerned that what we're building is something that doesn't get that kind of play anymore. We do have security issues. Without having it be a public rental facility, it's not going to get much play. We don't get a lot of people up there. And I thought that's part of what we were doing with the pocket parks was to start put that message out at different pocket parks throughout the valley on here's what you can do. And I'm wondering if something like this were to be built down below in the big park, we'd get lots of play. You'd have all kinds of people that would be going through it. But up here, I'm not so sure that we get the value out of it that we would like, especially $4 million worth of value. So I guess I'd have to think about this thing. I like the displays. I think that's a good idea. I'm to the point I'm not sure that we need a park to put it in anymore.
Dr. Cooper, when we held these private events, even your daughter's wedding, how much do you remember? How much we generated from those events?
No, we had a charge. I don't remember how much it was. We required caterers that people had to have. Then they had to have security as well, especially if you were having an event at night because staff is all gone. You had to have security people. It became very cumbersome, and it really became Karen Dakinger was spending full time on dealing with mothers and mothers of the bridezillas and bride mothers, I guess you would call them. So, yeah. I'm not sure of the value of going back to a park up here again. You know, if we took an area that's down in the park and we built a conservation garden down there for adults that might make sense. Here, our program really now is centered around students and the 12 to 14,000 kids that we get up here. There's lots of things that we can do. We can still do the displays. There's lots of things that we can do with them. But I'm not sure $4 million park is what we need to do.
Director Cooper, it's a great point, and just a couple of additional facts to add to that you're right. The strategy for promoting water efficient, sustainable landscapes to the community was to put more demonstration gardens out into the public so that they were more integrated into their daily activities, as opposed to having to go up to the garden during the workday, which is out of the way. It's inconvenient. So when we met with the teachers, what we discovered was that the garden at a point in time was really an exciting place for students to go and experience learning, and that it just lost that capacity over time due to the obsoletism or the slowly decay of the park. So that's why there is garden components in here, because our teachers notified that they still teach much about plants. And for a lot of disadvantaged community folks, this is their experience with gardens, the only kind of experience in these types of gardens that they may have. So they wanted to make sure that it incorporated that landscape. But then they also wanted to make learning about water super exciting, which from my perspective, and I think from this group's perspective, water is really exciting. From a young person's perspective, they don't know. They turn on the tap and they turn it off. So the idea was to have this global flow, again, from global water issues, state water issues, local water issues. Those are the capstone exhibits or the centerpiece exhibits for each section. Eventually, we would add more about conservation, about water footprint, about agriculture. So many things could be grown on there, because it does have in this plan a master plan of utility support underneath it that we could develop. So that's why we expanded the scope from just the conservatory garden to the conservatory garden and education experience, because we really wanted to showcase the amazing world of water to our youth and our future water leaders.
And I appreciate that. I guess it's the amount of money. This would be very difficult at our board, especially since we're going out for a bond issuance.
Yeah.
To say we're going to spend $4 million for a park, for a garden out here. And it's very difficult for people to come to this. They've got to go through a guard, and they've got to come up. And nobody knows that it's here. If there were a plan of how it were going to be used in some manner that's greater than just the students that we get, might help it. But I think we have the plan yet of what it would be used for.
Yeah, I share the same sentiment with Derek Cooper. If Mr. Dickens, if you could look back to the cost associated, the revenue generated from before 9/11, maybe we can get some sort of an ROI with actual numbers. In addition of having students up there using as an event space, adding the cost of personnel and any other sort of facilities needed in order to protect the plant during evening events or any other events. How do directors feel about that?
You know, I think if you start looking at events, we're going to get back into some difficulties again, but it has to be designed differently. You need electrical, you need lighting down there. There's a lot of things that you would need.
Restroom facilities too, right?
Restroom facilities. Well, yeah, the restroom facilities up above, but people, even Taste of the Town, they used to have to bring in generators to run things because there wasn't enough electricity down there.
One point of clarification, this does have utilities, potable water and electric utilities throughout the garden for lights. And so they still have to use the restroom facilities that are up near the globe. But it does have utility backbone for potable irrigation and electric utility.
That's good.
Yep.
All right. What sort of direction, Mr. Dickens and Mr. Cole, are you guys looking from the committee?
Well, we're looking for feedback. So, I mean, I think that's what Matt was doing. I mean, I want to take a minute just to thank Matt and the team for getting it to this point, right? We had direction to get a project shovel ready, and we were basing it upon the feedback that we had received kind of through a very long process at this point. So I just want to really thank the team. I think what they designed is a very unique facility and space. And so It is a top-notch looking facility. So I don't want to miss that context. But we're where we're at today, and I think that's what, you know, Matt's little spreadsheet was trying to do. Is gauge where do we want to go from here, and I'm hearing maybe looking at a little bit more information. You know, we do have the pocket park moving forward, so that is being constructed. We will have a period of time to let that settle in if we wanted to do that and see how that is received in the community. You know, there's no huge pressure on moving this project forward now, but there is a couple things that I think we're going to need to do regardless. We're going to have to do some kind of more decommission of what is there today, because there's some safety issues at the site.
Those walls were rammed earth walls made with polymer and
So we'd have to do something there. I think we still want to, what we've heard from the teachers, they've kind of created their own little space in the interim. And so it may be working with them to see how we can help that space serve the need that they are. But I guess the direction to your direct question, Chair Orzhovsky, is, you know, do you guys want to see us move forward with it or take a different path? We can definitely research the benefit of other uses of the space, get some information on that, come back to the committee. If you all feel that that would be helpful, we can definitely go through that process. And
or grants that are available. I think that would be a big
We have... and Cheryl reminded me by a text, but we have looked at a lot of grants. And I think what the grant, we're not getting the grant. This type of project is not fitting well with the grants that we're seeing. I think we would need to partner with a school district or somebody else that has access to more park type things, right? That it doesn't really fit our mission. The educational piece does. So I think that's what we would have to spend some time doing, you know, reaching out to the school district, see if they're interested in partnering on applying for grant funding. We have looked a lot at kind of the typical grant world that we're in. That's just not a good fit.
It's because of the public access issue, and then also the location is not a disadvantaged community. So, you know, there may be some ways to frame this to kind of meet the spirit, but it certainly is outside of a DAC. You know, it's not located inside a disadvantaged community, and a lot of those grants for parks are prioritizing those, and of course other attributes. I did also hear, though, from the committee that there's the idea of developing the engagement and utility plan. And I think that's a really good question and something that staff needs to step back and say, how would this space be used for the useful life of that project? And that would be a very valuable exercise that could help develop those cost benefit analysis and, you know, cost per visitor estimates and those types of things. So,
you know, partnering with the school district is something I was thinking about. I was going to ask about the grants, but you've already explained that. What is the possibility of also partnering with the city on this, having a joint facility that's a city school district water agency facility, because it is adjoining Central Park. You know, access to it's not going to be the same as other parts of Central Park, but there may be funding opportunities if we can partner with those organizations.
Mr. Dickens, have you reached out to the city regarding this park?
Not specifically to the conservatory garden, other than looking at the building permit kind of requirements. But we do have a good working relationship with city parks as we're working on the Bridgeport Park Sustainable Landscape Demonstration Garden. So I can certainly add that to our conversation.
Okay, just for my clarification. Just for my clarification. So we moved to pocket parks so that we do not focus our finances on a park here at Rio. Is that correct? Was that the intention?
You can answer that one if you want.
I think that the strategy was because the garden at Rio, the conservatory garden, is really focused on child education and very specific adult education. We see value in providing, the native landscape palettes for residential customers to engage with, but having those facilities at the Rio Vista didn't make a lot of sense because people would have to come up to the garden during their work hours. So we decided to bifurcate and take the sustainable landscape designs out to the public at places where they interact and where they can visit 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, whereas the conservatory garden really is focused on specifically having students up and then some adult education classes. It's been very difficult to bring homeowners up to that facility to teach them about sustainable landscapes.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. It'll be a steep climb.
It's a high price tag, especially since our last board meeting regarding them.
Really nice facility. I mean, it would be wonderful. I think we'd have to show the value to the board of what it's going to be used for and how we're going to get our value out of that. I think we need to show them more of that somehow. It has to be more than just the kids coming up.
Well, let us go back. I think that's good direction, as Matt said. Let's go back and take in what we heard, and we can think about that and try and really get after the value proposition. You know, this idea of how would you use the space, and define that more clearly, and then we'll come back and we can talk about that and see what we get.
Okay, and just to echo what you said, Mr. Cole, the plans look phenomenal. They look great. You know, the shade structures, the amphitheater, the sustainability shack. I mean, it's the models. They look great. So, kudos to you and your team for coming up with the design. Okay. Any other comments, questions?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dickens.
Thank you.
All right. We move to item number 5, committee plan calendar. Mr. Cole.
Nothing specific, it's there for your review. I'll leave you with anything you wanted to add.
All right. Now, any questions from the public? All right, we're going to move to item 6, adjournment. Thank you, everyone, for coming today. Thank you for the team, the staff. Always enjoy these committees. All right, adjournment.
Thank you all.